Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome. When we hear about budget problems in California schools, we usually think of teachers losing their jobs. But school nurses are also worried about job security and cuts to student health services. Correspondent Shelley Bronco spoke with school nurses and one Visalia family who relies on them.
It is 1:20.
Great.
It's lunchtime at Valley Oak Middle School in Visalia. Seventh grader Dalton Lambert is ready to tear into his lunch, but first he visits school nurse Terry Lingberg. Lambert has diabetes. The nurse helps him check his blood sugar, count carbs, and prepare a dose of insulin.
Let's see, we have a burrito with 41. Oh, chimichanga.
School nurses don't just hand out ice packs and bandages. They help students manage chronic conditions such as diabetes and asthma. Lambert says he can't imagine going without that extra help.
It'd be really hard. It'd be very, very hard, actually.
In emergencies such as severe allergic reactions, school nurses can save lives. But in many districts, the nurse is becoming an endangered species. State budget cuts are leaving districts to decide whether to lay off teachers or staff like nurses. Visalia Unified School District has lost around 6 nursing positions to retirements and budget cuts in the last 4 years. Student Services Director Lucinda Mydell Aubrey says the schools have to share nurses. It's made the nurses' workload much harder. The federal government recommends a ratio of 1 nurse to 750 students. Mydell Aubrey says in Visalia, each nurse is responsible for 2,500 children.
It's a challenge for them when there's emergencies going on at the schools and they need to respond back to another school. That's probably one of the most challenging situations, not being there when an emergency is occurring.
Next year, the district will lose a position in special education nursing. Mydell Aubrey says that nurse won't be laid off, but she will go back to helping elementary students. The Valley Oak nurse, Terry Lindberg, worries about the effects of further budget cuts on low-income students. Struggling parents often take their sick children to her instead of a clinic. She hands out referrals when she can't treat them herself.
Low-income families might be kind of pushed away because they aren't able to pay, and I think that if something comes from the school nurse, the doctors are more likely to take care of the children.
California school districts pay for nurses in a variety of ways, using money from their general funds, grants, and Medi-Cal. California schools are required to provide screenings and other health services. But in other states, such as Delaware, schools must have nurses at each campus. Barbara Miller is the president of the California School Nurses Organization.
We would love to go that direction because that's really going to be the only way that we can protect our kids, is by having that mandate so that we know those nursing services are there for the students.
Other school health initiatives are at the mercy of state and federal budget cuts. Clovis Unified School District runs health centers at 2 schools. They provide many uninsured students with physical exams, immunizations, and other routine services. Clovis Unified's nursing coordinator, Jeannie Prandini, says the district pays for its health centers largely from its own funds. The district applied for a federal grant to build a new health center at Sierra Vista Elementary School. But Congress is moving to repeal those funds, which are part of the Affordable Care Act.
If it doesn't happen, I think, and especially with the budget the way it is, everything will go back on a back burner for now.
Back in Visalia, Dalton Lambert's mother, Cindy, says her family has health insurance, but she relies on the school nurse to keep her diabetic son on the right track.
I'd have to be taken off work to come to school and to help him check his carb counts if there wasn't a nurse on campus.
School nurses say they are often the first line of defense in a child's health. They also point out that a healthy child stays in school and is ready to learn. I'm Shelley Bronco.
And this is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Shelley Bronco joins us in our studio now, and it's very interesting that line being that first line of defense for many of these low-income families and children who otherwise may not see a medical professional. As I understand it, on Monday mornings, there's actually a line sometimes for students to see the nurse. Is that correct?
That's right. Some of the nurses I spoke to said that parents will wait over the weekend if there's a minor illness or injury, sometimes even a fracture, because they trust the nurse and they believe that it's just an easier way to get medical services or get that referral.
Now, another issue that has come up in this overall discussion, we're looking at school health, and you mentioned students with diabetes. This is a concern that's of special interest to many here in the Valley. The issue specifically being who is qualified to give an injection, to give an insulin shot to a child with this disease. As I understand it right now, state law is rather clear and the courts have ruled on this particular issue that only trained professionals can do that. But I mean, many are advocating for a change in that.
Right. There are some discussions and even court cases. There have been court battles over this that the American Diabetes Association recommended that, you know, it's all right for staff to give insulin shots if necessary, if it comes to that point. But nurses organizations are saying, no, that's really, you know, a bad idea because you have to – it's a dangerous medication, insulin, and you have to be very careful how you administer it. So only someone who's qualified medically to do that should be giving these kinds of shots.
Well, Shelley, thank you very much for that report. We'll continue this discussion in just a moment and learn more about another health issue impacting school-aged children, immunizations. We'll talk about whooping cough and more coming up in our next segment of Quality of Life. Stay with us. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore, and we're talking about school nurse programs and the various health issues impacting our schools. And joining us now on the telephone, we have two guests. We have Linda Davis Aldrit. She is the school nurse consultant for the California Department of Education. And we also have Kevin Hamilton, deputy chief of the Clinica Sierra Vista program from California. Again, welcome to our program, Linda and Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As we are talking about this issue of school nurses, I'll first turn to Linda and get your input on this issue. This is something that has been a concern now for some time as schools' budgets are increasingly under the budget crunch that is facing so much of our public life in California. How are school nurses faring from your perspective, and how are these programs surviving in this challenging fiscal era?
Well, as I think has been pointed out by some of the speakers on the earlier segment, in California, the number of school nurses is dependent on which district decides to hire nurses and which doesn't. There's no requirement in California for districts to have a school nurse, so it varies from no school nurses at all in a school district or in a school to schools that have a full-time school nurse. So it's just all over the map.
And I imagine you're seeing this disparity throughout the state and various districts. Are those that generally are serving more underserved population more likely to not have those types of services?
It really depends on the district. It's typically the issue is not a shortage of school nurses, but a shortage of funded positions in the districts. And districts have the choice to allocate money for school nursing or allocate it for something else.
Is there a long-term trend in terms of looking back, giving this some context? Has this been an issue that is just a recent matter with the current budget crisis, or does this go back longer? Did we have a much better program years ago?
Yeah, it goes back quite a while, actually, to the passage of Proposition 13 in the 70s. Prior to that time, most schools in California had a school nurse. If you grow up in California in the 50s and the 60s, the chances of you having a school nurse at your school were very high. Most schools had a full-time school nurse. And since the late 70s, the trend has reversed and the numbers of school nurses has declined, again, because of unfunded positions.
We're talking about school health, school nurses, and programs of that sort today on Quality of Life. We'd like to hear from you, our listeners. You can call us with your questions or comments. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Linda, we heard in the report some discussion about in the Clovis School District a clinic program that they're applying for funding from the Affordable Care Act. Are you seeing that in districts throughout the state, school districts looking to look at new sources of funding for these sorts of programs in the schools?
Absolutely. Yeah, many, many districts are looking at alternative ways of delivering services. And, you know, certainly having a school-based health center is a very positive thing, depending on the need in the particular district, but that doesn't mean that there's still not a need for school nurses. There's been some studies done in other states about the value of having a school nurse even when there's a school-based health center within the district. The school nurse acts as a referral source to that clinic, makes appropriate referrals, and deals with the ongoing chronic needs of students, taking care of their diabetes, as you've heard, their asthma, and any other issues that come up on the campus that don't rise to the level of needing to be seen at the clinic.
Now, I know there's a new state law that has an impact on schools, an impact on parents and kids, and we'll talk about that new law in regards to whooping cough vaccinations in just a moment. But I want to turn to our other guest, Kevin Hamilton from Clinica Sierra Vista, which serves a great portion of the San Joaquin Valley. Kevin, you serve a lot of underserved populations. What are you seeing from parents and school-aged children in terms of their access to health care at that particular age group?
Well, access to health care for underserved populations, folks that don't have insurance, folks that have Medi-Cal and an ever-dwindling supply of physicians who are willing to take Medi-Cal as the reimbursement for Medi-Cal continues to decline over time. And the geographic layout of the valley make access to health care problematic for not only children, but for everyone in the valley who is poor, disadvantaged, has transportation issues and lives in the more remote areas of the valley or in the rural areas of the valley in small communities that don't have a lot of resources. Clinica Sierra Vista has over 30 clinics across three counties in Indio, Fresno, and Kern. And many of our clinics are in small rural towns where we have one doctor or two doctors with a nurse, and the population of the community may be 5 to 7, 8, 9, 10,000.
And that's a very interesting topic because as we talk about this issue of vaccinations, and I'll turn back to Linda now, last September, the governor signed a new law requiring students entering grades 7 through 12 to receive a booster shot for pertussis, commonly known as whooping cough. This is something that takes effect this coming school year, starting in August. I imagine this has to be a challenge in order to serve this entire population of young students who may not have had this shot already, especially in areas where they may not have great access to such services or spread out in rural areas. Linda, tell us a little more about this particular law and what's being done to provide these immunizations.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up because this is a monumental law that was passed, as you said, last September, and it does address specifically pertussis or whooping cough. The vaccine is called Tdap, and it stands for tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. It is an adult formulation. This was just licensed in 2005, so it's a relatively new form of a vaccine that we're all very familiar with. And it does affect every student entering public and private schools in grades 7 through 12, beginning, as you said, this summer. Actually, the implementation date is July 1, and it will affect any student coming into California schools, middle schools and high schools, 7th through 12th grade, this fall. We estimate that there's about 1.5 million students in California that have not received the Tdap vaccine, and it is a one-shot. Parents need to check with their physician. There, many physicians have been giving that vaccine, but the parents do need to bring proof of the vaccine to the school so that their child can enter school without any delay when they come in the fall. It is best to get the vaccine done now, not to wait until summer, because clinics and doctor's offices are going to be very full. What we are suggesting is that parents take their students to their own personal physician or the clinic where they usually get care for the vaccine. And if they don't have a physician or a clinic that they usually go to, there is more information on how to access a clinic that can provide free vaccine for those who are eligible. And the website is eziz.org. And then I have a telephone number, toll-free, that people could call.
Sure, go ahead.
877-243-8832.
Now, turning to Kevin, how are you prepared for something like this? What are you seeing in the field and in terms of getting the word out to families and those who may be in rural areas, underserved populations? Are they aware of this new requirement when it comes to go back to school in August?
We find that the schools are very aware, and they've been doing the best that they can to get the information out to local communities. Keep in mind that as providers, we were noticed about this on a letter we received January 11th of this year, that the new program would be going into effect February 1st. That was a notice that we got from the California Department of Public Health, letting us know this whole thing was actually moving forward. That letter was sent to providers all over California so that they'd all be noticed at the same time. I have the same recommendations as our other caller, that we really need to get parents motivated to get these kids into their clinics, to call. If they don't have a doctor, they can call their local health centers. There's community health centers all over California. They can go on Clinica Sierra Vista's website at clinicasierravista.org to find some resources. EZIZ is a great website. I find that it's confusing for some parents. As it starts out in English and you have to be able to figure out how to get to the Spanish version of the site. Tremendous number of the patients we serve are Spanish-speaking only. And then we have another smaller minority of folks who are Southeast Asian and don't speak English or Spanish or read or write either one very well. So this is very challenging. Health departments all over California have been working with schools to better provide this service. For instance, in Fresno, the Fresno County Health Department, for the 2 weeks of spring break here, is running a Tdap immunization clinic from 8 to 4 daily for the next 2 weeks, and they can simply contact the Fresno County Department of Health to get that information about how to access that. Parents also need to know that this doesn't need to be a huge cost burden for them. We have a lot of folks out there whose children are not documented. That's always a worry for those folks, and they need to understand that they can access vaccines for free through the Vaccines for Children program. Again, at community health centers, and some physicians operate this program. All community health centers operate this program. And through that program, they'll get the vaccine for free, and there'll be an administration fee of $9, so essentially they'll pay $9 and they'll get their vaccine. If they want to get the rest of the family vaccinated, community health centers in general will only charge $15 for administration fee, and the vaccine, again, will be free. So this is a huge resource for folks, and we really want to get the word out about it. It's so important not to wait till the last minute. And it's also so important not to expect that county health centers or county health departments all over the state, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, are going to continue to have this resource. I spoke recently to the health department director, and they have a limited number of vaccines down there. So once they run out, they're pretty much out, and they can't get any more on short notice. I've spoken to the state of California, California Department of Public Health Immunization Branch, and they're running anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks out on orders. So they need to get notice well ahead of time. If somebody runs out of vaccine, it won't be like it used to be where we could get that vaccine tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
The state budget situation has significantly impacted our ability to purchase and hold vaccines in large quantities in stores at the state level. So people need to be thinking about these kinds of things. Get out there now and get their kids vaccinated. Do not wait until the week that they go in with their packet to register their child. They're turned around at the door and said your child won't be able to get in school until they get this vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you find yourself in a waiting room in a doctor's office or a clinic for a day and a half. You'll be really unhappy about that, I guarantee you.
Let's turn back to Linda Davis-Aldrett, the California School Nurse Consultant for the California Department of Education. Pertussis is something that is in the news a lot more now than it used to be. Why is that? Are we having an epidemic in California?
We actually are. Over the past year, there has, for the all of 2010, there was a whooping cough epidemic in California. We had over 3,000 deaths in 2010. The incidence of whooping cough is still high, much higher than we would expect it to be, and that's the main reason why this new law was passed. Whooping cough starts out like a little cold, but it doesn't go away, and the classic symptom is a cough with a whooping sound. And that cough lingers and lingers and lingers. It's often called the 100-day cough because it lasts so long. So not only are people very ill, there's a risk, especially for people who are not immunized against the disease, young babies. We had several deaths of children who were not old enough to be immunized last year. And for people who are older, whose immune systems have begun to wane, the risk is very high for them as well. So it's highly contagious disease. It can easily be spread in the school setting, and that's the rationale behind this new requirement.
We're talking about health in our schools today on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. You can call us with your questions or comments. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Linda, this is an issue that has come up recently in terms of immunizations, vaccinations. It seems like there is a trend over the past few years that more parents are choosing not to have certain vaccines, have their children vaccinated for certain diseases. Is this a growing concern, and how does this relate to the whooping cough?
It is definitely a growing concern that people are choosing to not have their children vaccinated, and the more children who are not vaccinated, the higher the risk for those children becoming ill and for them to spread it to others who basically have little defense against disease and can't be immunized, like infants and elderly people whose immune system has begun to break down, or other people who are on medication that causes their immune system to be weaker. It is definitely a significant issue and a great issue of concern that so many people are declining immunizations. The immunizations have been proven over and over again to be very safe, and they're definitely very effective against these vaccine-preventable communicable diseases. And it is a problem.
Turning now to Kevin Hamilton, the Deputy Chief of Program for Clinica Sierra Vista, you're dealing with a lot of populations that perhaps are new to this country and are underserved. They may, as you mentioned earlier, have concerns about their legal status and other things like that. What about getting the word out to them about the importance of immunizations in general? Are there cultural barriers to overcome there, or is that population more interested in those types of services than perhaps others that are afraid or concerned about these issues?
There's definitely cultural barriers to overcome there. People don't always come here looking at Western medicine as the be-all and end-all for their solutions. They've quite often not had access to those kinds of resources and have come up with solutions that they feel are more effective for their community, even though we know very well that they are not, and that often those solutions leave them at risk. We have a whole program focused at outreach and immunization that works through various cultural networks and agencies that support these folks and help them to adapt to the American culture. And we've been very successful in getting this population immunized. The state of California felt that this was so important not so long ago that they had a free Tdap program for families with infants who were a year and younger, and we participated aggressively in that program, and it allowed us to not only immunize the children, but all of the family members who would be in contact with that child. And we still have some of that vaccine left, and we still continue to do that program with our young mothers. And it gives us an opportunity, those programs give us an opportunity to educate those families about not only Tdap, but vaccines in general. And the school system's been very helpful in the laws regarding school entry. Most of these folks want their kids in schools. They want them to get a good education. And once they realize they won't be able to get into school without completing their vaccination schedule, we find them to be very compliant.
Turning back to Linda, this is a concern that is, it's somewhat unique. This is somewhat of a historic event, going back to the whooping cough vaccination. This new law is rather unique in terms of applying to such a broad base of California students and bringing them in all at once. Give us some context in that regard.
Yes, it is very unique. This is the first time in the history of the immunization program in California that we've selected such a large population. Typically, we've had immunization requirements for school entry, so kindergarten or first grade. We've had some catch-up immunization requirements for children in seventh grade. Most recently, we've had this chickenpox vaccine and the hepatitis B vaccine at seventh grade. But this time, because of the epidemic that we were experiencing last year in California and that seems to be continuing, the legislature was looking at a bill that would have required Tdap, pertussis vaccine, at seventh grade. And as it evolved, it became a concern, and the legislature decided that they were going to include all students in grades 7 through 12 to make sure that everyone was caught up as quickly as possible. After this year, after the 2011-12 school year, then the requirement will only apply to incoming 7th graders. But for this one school year, we will be doing all students in grades 7 through 12. And again, remember, it's public and private school students that are affected, so all students in California.
Have we learned anything from the case of H1N1 and other recent concerns about about immunization in large numbers? Is there anything to learn from those scenarios?
Well, one of the things that was really effective during H1N1, and because there were resources that were put forward to provide vaccination against H1N1, there was quite a bit of federal money that came to the states to put together both community clinics and school-based vaccination clinics. Unfortunately, that's not the case with pertussis or with the Tdap vaccination requirement. There's very little public money available for the implementation of this new law. So on the one hand, we learned that school-based vaccination clinics were very effective in getting both children and their families vaccinated against H1N1. And this time with Tdap, we don't have that those resources available.
Well, again, we want to thank you for taking time to join us today. We've been talking with Linda Davis Aldrich. She is the school nurse consultant for the California Department of Education. And also on the phone, joining us from Clinica Sierra Vista, the Deputy Chief of Program, Kevin Hamilton. Thank you both for joining us today on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment with a follow-up to last week's conversation about the Fresno Unified School District. It sparked a lot of conversation and controversy. We'll get another perspective on the challenges facing the district in just a moment, coming up next on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. Welcome back to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Last week, our interview with author and journalist Mark Arax sparked a good deal of discussion, including both praise and criticism. In addition to talk about topics ranging from the development industry to the Westside land baron J.G. Boswell, Arax took aim at the Fresno Unified School District, calling it arguably the most broken district in the state. Arax is also a member of the group Bullard Pride, which advocates splitting up the district, which is the fourth largest in the state. In addition to his criticism of the district's performance and policies, he also leveled serious claims about District Superintendent Michael Hansen's driving record and accused him of being involved in an unreported traffic accident involving a young child. These charges came after earlier revelations about Hansen's driving record in the Fresno Bee, including numerous speeding tickets and driving with an expired license. The interview sparked considerable discussion in the local media over the last week and further investigation into the alleged incident. Several school board members have since called for a formal inquiry into the matters. Our listeners also spoke out. We fielded a great number of calls after the program from people who appreciated hearing Arax's views and allegations. We also heard from a number of people who felt differently. One listener, Lisa in Fresno, wrote the following. Did anyone at KVPR vet Mr. Arax before allowing him to speak or fact-checked his assertions about FUSD? She continued, how did this show come about? Did he approach the station or was he invited? Will Quality of Life be used by others with a particular beef to vent their frustration, and will this be tolerated by the station? Well, Lisa, we'd like to thank you for that email. To be clear, the station approached Mr. Arax to be a guest, not the other way around. We invited him on our program to talk about his books and other recent works. Arax agreed and indicated he would also like to talk about public education, as it's the subject of his most recent research. We agreed and anticipated the discussion would involve the Bullard Pride issue and Fresno Unified in general. However, we were not aware of the specific charges Arax made about Superintendent Hansen's driving record, the alleged incident, prior to the live broadcast. After last Tuesday's broadcast, the station extended an invitation to Superintendent Hansen to appear on this week's program and address the issues. While Mr. Hansen is not here today, our offer stands for future programs. One of the core values of public radio is balanced civil discussion, a refuge from the increasingly tabloid-driven nature of the rest of the news media with sensationalized coverage of issues large and small. In the wake of last week's discussion and those public radio values, we felt it would only be appropriate to present a different perspective on Fresno Unified. Joining us now in the Bonner Performing Arts Studio is one of the principal authors of a report called Choosing Our Future, a community-wide call to action, a proposal to transform the Fresno Unified School District. It was prepared for the district by the Superintendent's Advisory Task Force back in 2005. Pete Weber is also a member of the Board of Directors of the nonprofit Fresno Business Council. Pete, welcome to our program today.
Thank you very much, Joe.
One of the claims that Mr. Arax made was that the district is, under Superintendent Hansen's leadership, the most broken in the state. And in order to rebut some of those claims, I think it might be helpful to hear where the district was, from your perspective,
prior to Superintendent Hansen taking this job back in 2005 or 2006. I believe your involvement predates that with this report. Tell us where we were when the prior superintendent, Santiago Wood, was dismissed.
Well, you know, what happened, Joe, is that Dr. Walt Buster took over as the interim superintendent. And I remember going in to see Dr. Buster a couple of weeks after he'd taken on the job, pro bono, by the way, for 6 months. Community owes him a huge debt of gratitude for doing that difficult work. And Walt said to me, Pete, look, I knew that things were broken. I just didn't realize everything is broken, and I need some help. And he asked us to put together a task force to take a look at putting together a turnaround plan for Fresno Unified School District. And we did that. And indeed, everything was broken. I mean, we benchmarked Fresno Unified against schools in California with similar demographics and found that there were schools with very similar demographics that were performing much, much better than Fresno Unified. Fresno Unified at the time was fiscally broken. I mean, we were on the verge of a state takeover because we were essentially bankrupt. And we were at the same time academically bankrupt. The benchmarking showed, for example, that while Fresno Unified had 51% of its schools in decile one, the bottom 10% of the state, Garden Grove had no schools in decile one, and Long Beach had 8% of its schools in decile one. At the other end of the spectrum, while Garden Grove had 68% of its schools in deciles 6 through 10, and Long Beach, as I recall, had 44% of its schools in decile 6 through 10. Fresno Unified had only 18% of its schools in decile 6 through 10. So we were academically bankrupt. We were financially bankrupt. And, you know, our special ed programs didn't work. Our technology was declared by FICMAT, the Fiscal Crisis Management Assistance team, to be probably the worst in the state for any large urban school district. You know, everything, as I say, was broken at the time.
The state was also – there were rumors or discussion of the state being ready to take over the district.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was for fiscal reasons. So they should have also – you know, there isn't a fiscal crisis management attention team that looks at taking over school districts for academic bankruptcy. But, you know, they could have considered that as well because we were academically bankrupt. I mean, you know, when 51% of our schools are at the bottom of the state, bottom 10%, then, you know, clearly stuff is broken. I know there's been some recent discussion about suspensions and expulsions and so on. We were expelling kids at a rate higher than that of any other school that we compared ourselves to. You know, Garden Grove, Long Beach. In fact, you know, compared to Long Beach, we were as I recall, 15 times the rate of expulsions that Long Beach had. So it was horrible what was going on. If you want me to transition to what's happened since then, happy to do that.
Well, I think that's a good place to go. Let me preface it by this. Certainly, I don't know that there's many people out there who would, looking back at the situation following the departure of Santiago Wood, the interim leadership of Walt Buster, say that the district was in a good place at that time. I think that's fairly well established throughout the community, regardless of the various sides that people may take on issues today in Fresno Unified. Superintendent Hansen came to Fresno, a relatively young superintendent with bold new ideas. He gained a lot of support from leaders such as yourself, the folks with the Business Council and many of the other collaborative efforts to transform Fresno, to align resources. What was it that you saw in Mr. Hansen as he took over the district initially?
Well, look, you know, Mike has brought enormous passion and energy. He's just a tremendously dedicated human being who has, I think, nothing but the interest of our kids at heart. But I want to make sure to give credit to the Board of Trustees, the staff, the teachers. I mean, everybody has contributed, and frankly, the community. I mean, we've got a lot of adult mentors now who are working with you know, troubled kids in the district and so on. I think it's been a team effort, and the turnaround has been dramatic. Let me tell you, I've had a lot of experience with turnarounds, some bad, some good. They're extraordinarily difficult. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, taking an old Fresno B building and trying to convert it into a Metropolitan Museum. Very difficult to do. You run into asbestos problems. You run into all kinds of unpredictable things. It's a lot easier sometimes to start from scratch, start something new. Well, you know, Mike Hansen and the board didn't have that choice. They had to work with what was there, and they have done, I think, an admirable job. I have nothing but the greatest respect for the turnaround that has taken place. Now, do we still have a long way to go? Absolutely. But, you know, I can give you a lot of specifics on what has happened in a short period of time, if you'd like me to do that.
Yeah, certainly. And again, you're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Pete Weber is our guest. He is one of the principal authors of a report that the district commissioned, the Fresno Unified School District commissioned in 2005, charting a transformational course for their future operations on the verge of state takeover for its finances and not to mention poor academic performance. Of course, we'd like to hear what you think about this issue. You can call us with your questions or comments, 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Looking back now, we're in 2011. The school year is about to come to a close. This was in 2005 when this report was commissioned. Have we seen market improvement in, from your perspective? Some would say that things are just as bad, if not worse.
Yeah, I don't buy that at all. I mean, absolutely we've seen market improvement. Let me give you some specifics. Financially, 5 years of unqualified audits. The finances of the school district were a total shambles at the time that we looked at it. Academically, less than 20% of our kids were reading or doing math at grade level at the time that we looked at the district, less than 20%. Today, over 40%. So we've more than doubled that. And let me put some real faces on this. That means that 15,000 students – more students are now able to read, do math at grade level. Now, does that leave room for continued improvement? Absolutely. So, you know, but you know, more than double the number of kids who are proficient. I remember FICMAT, when they came in, saying that the technology at the school district was probably the worst in the state. Today, it is looked at as one of the best in the state. We were the first district to put in, you know, all wireless access in the classrooms. We have the largest fiber optic network in the state. Every classroom has 100 to 500 megabit access. The Atlas system, you know, is doing an extraordinary job. It's a student information system that is being looked at by other school districts as a model. It was actually co-developed by Microsoft in the school district. It's got to save the district a lot of money and provide students, parents, teachers with a lot of information they didn't have before. Our expulsions are way down from what they were. Our suspensions are down from what they were. And we have programs, in-school programs to deal with kids in suspension that we didn't have before. So we're trying to modify the behaviors. You know, we're taking the kids outside of the mainstream classrooms until they can get back in there because they've modified their behaviors and so on. I think, Joe, that the community recognizes the improvements that have taken place. And part of the reason I say that is that when you get a 76% approval on a bond measure for facilities at a school district, that's just not only a recognition that facilities need to be improved and modernized. It's also a vote of confidence in the leadership. And so I think that Mike Hansen and the board and the staff deserve a lot of kudos for what has been accomplished to date. Let me reemphasize, a lot more work needs to be done, and nobody is more conscious of that than the trustees and Mike Hansen.
Again, we'd like to hear your thoughts and comments about Fresno Unified School District. Is the district on the right track, in your opinion, or is a change needed? The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. One of the concerns that Mr. Arax brought up, and I think is a very legitimate one, centers around McLean High School and the poor performance at that school, serving a largely diverse population in one of the Fresno's established neighborhoods. This is a school that recently lost a significant amount of funding because of its lack of performance. Is this, in your opinion, evidence of a larger problem with the district, or how do you explain something like that? Not that you need to explain such a complex issue. Let me rephrase that. How does that impact this overall trend that you're telling us about improvement?
Yeah, let me give you some perspective on that. I think Mike Hansen, the board of trustees, nobody's more disappointed than they are with the fact that McLean lost that funding. But to put that in perspective, we have 18 schools in the district that are under this CUIA funding that, you know, McLean was under. So one of the 18 schools didn't make its mark. And by the way, I don't recall all of the stats, but I believe that they had something like 10 or 11 performance measures, and they failed to meet one of those performance measures. Now, I got to tell you that, you know, Mike Hansen, the staff, trustees, they're all over that issue, and they're going to get it fixed. And the thing that I love about the staff that is there now is that, you know, they don't shy away from attacking problems. I mean, if they need to intervene, they will intervene. I think it's, you know, 2/3 or, you know, maybe even 75% of all of the principals in the school district are new in their positions. Now, some of them have been promoted from inside. Some of them have been brought in from the outside. But, you know, it's much of this is about leadership, and it's leadership at the school level. I mean, we have some really great teachers, but, you know, if they don't have good principals who are supporting them and giving them what they need and so on and so forth, we're not going to get very far. So, you know, in some cases, you know, we've done better than in others. But look, 7 of the 8 high schools last year showed improvements in API performance. We've had a steady ascension in API scores during the time that Mike Hansen has been superintendent. And again, I give a lot of credit to the board. I think it's a good board. I think they work very, very hard. They have their differences from time to time, but for the most part, I give them very, very high grades.
This is an issue that many large urban school districts have faced nationwide in terms of leadership at the top. We've seen just in the last few weeks, City of New York dismiss its newly appointed superintendent after a very short tenure. Again, somebody who was touted as bringing bold ideas, new vision to a troubled system. Washington, D.C. has had a similar situation. Another bold visionary leader left the job after a little bit longer tenure, but still, this is a very challenging job. I can't imagine that many public positions must be more challenging than to be a superintendent of a large urban school district. How do you see Fresno as fitting into that picture, and in terms of being able to attract and retain talent at a district like this?
Yeah, incredibly challenging situation, Joe. You're right. And I mean, you don't have to go very far. I mean, you look at Stockton, for example, and what has gone through. You know, they recruited this guy D'Amato, you know, with big credentials and so on and so forth. He lasted less than 2 years. These are incredibly difficult, situations that we're facing in our urban school districts. And attracting leadership to particularly superintendents is very, very difficult to do. Most superintendents don't last very long. That's part of the reason that we have the urban problems that we do, because continuity of leadership is huge. I mean, in the analysis that we made in 2004, You know, we compared ourselves, for example, to Clovis Unified. And Clovis Unified had had three superintendents, I think, over 27 years or something like that, during the same period of time that Fresno Unified had had 10 superintendents. And you can't do it that way. You have to have continuity of leadership, assuming, of course, that the leadership is good. And I think there's lots of evidence to say that the leadership that we've got at Fresno Unified is very strong.
We just got an email here, actually a off-air comment, rather, from Shantae in Fresno. She says she hasn't heard us mention that Fresno Unified has high-performing schools that beat out Clovis Unified, such as she says, Gibson Elementary, Bullard Talent, Baird Middle School, et cetera, have some of the highest state test scores. There are good examples
we
as
have
well.
Extraordinary schools at Fresno Unified. In fact, in the Choosing Our Future report, we highlighted the fact that despite the dysfunction that existed within Fresno Unified, there were these heroic efforts on the part of some, principals and some schools, that had just done an extraordinary job. And Shantae is correct in bringing up some examples of that. I want to mention one other one that I think has a relationship to the McLean situation, and that is Duncan. Duncan Polytechnic is a school that a lot of kids want to come to. It's very close to McLean. It draws some of the cream to Duncan and away from McLean. So McLean presents some particular challenges, which, I know that Mike Hansen, the staff, and the trustees are very aware of, and that means that we could pay all the more attention to McLean.
Let's go to the phones now and talk to Dave from Selma. Dave, you're on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio with Pete Weber.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I just want to say that your guest today seems to be making a lot of sense and backed up with some, I think, reasonably good statistical evidence. And I think this is unlike the person who was taking the negative side last time. And I'm really glad to hear it.
Well, Dave, do you have any comment about the district or anything in regards to the topic with Fresno Unified, specifically?
I have to tell you the truth. I'm a very old man. I have, I think, 6 grandchildren, and none of them are involved with the Fresno School District. But I took issue with what I considered a rather vehement attack last time. So I'm just saying to you that, no, I don't have any involvement with the school district, but I am glad to see someone speak on the subject with what I consider reasonably good evidence. That's all I have to say.
Well, Dave, thank you very much for that call, and we always here at Public Radio seek to present multiple sides to a story, and I think that's one of the things we're trying to do today, and look at the various issues in context from last week's program, as you can call us as well with your thoughts and comments about Fresno Unified. Is the district on the right course or on the wrong path? 559-275-8989 or toll free 800-224-8989. One of the big challenges, Pete, in being a leader of a school district such as Fresno Unified or any large organization is you have many interests that are perhaps at not always in agreement, shall we say, to put it gently.
Sure.
Coalition building and teamwork, fostering common goals with groups that have different perspectives on issues, that's a challenging thing. How do you think Superintendent Hansen has done at that, considering the divisiveness we still see today?
Yeah, I think he's done reasonably well. Having said that, the number of challenges that our school district was facing when Mike got in here, the number of position changes that he had to make, leadership changes that he had to make. I mean, I can tell you personally that, I haven't talked to Mike in several weeks, but if I ever get to talk to him, he's generally calling me after 10 o'clock at night because that's when he can, he can take the time because he's been working, 16-hour days, sometimes longer than that. The communication challenge is huge. The coalition building that you refer to is vitally important. There's only so much time in the day, and it's difficult to do it all. But for the most part, I mean, think about – you take a look at the votes that have taken place on the board, and you'll find that most of them are 7-0 votes. There are a few issues that are controversial, and they tend to get most of the attention. And there are some groups that occasionally, take issue with what the superintendent is doing, and they get most of the attention. The positives get relatively little attention. So that's why I'm pleased that you invited me to, participate in your program.
Let's go back to the phones now and talk to Chris in Fresno. Chris, you're on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
Good morning. Hello.
Yes, go right ahead, Chris.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Weber. And I wanted to thank you for making the points this morning about the improvements in the district. And just noting that I personally looked up and was able to determine that Bullard High School, their API had increased over the last 2 years, where it appeared Mr. Arox was saying that there was a decline in a certain metric. And wanted to thank you for bringing up the points and the improvements this morning.
Thank you, Chris. This is tough work, in the specific case of Bullard, there was a change in superintendent. The APIs actually did go down for a couple of years. They went back up last year. In fact, Bullard had the second highest improvement among the high schools in Fresno last year. Edison did remarkably well. I mean, they improved their API by 33 points. That's huge. And as I mentioned yesterday, seven of the eight schools improved their API last year. So, sometimes it's true that you take two steps forward and you take one step back. I mean, leadership is absolutely vitally important. And I think that Bullard now has a superintendent. He's only been on the job for 1 year. A principal that is really doing a good job.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for that call today on Quality of Life. And Pete, as we just have a few moments left, the report you drafted back in 2005, let's say that the superintendent called the same group together or a new group, but you were a part of it now in 2011 and asked you to write a similar report in terms of charting the district's course for the future, its challenges today, also building on its successes. What would you, in an executive summary form, give in terms of recommendations right now?
Well, let me tell you, in order to be able to do that well, I would benchmark again and do the benchmarking that we did back in 2004 to see how we're doing compared to other schools. I think I know what some of that would say. I think that they would say that, we have in some cases leapfrogged other school districts. I mean, in technology today, I would tell you that we're probably better than Garden Grove or Long Beach. In academic performance, I think we probably, have a long way to go still to catch up. But I think we're definitely pointed in the right direction.
Well, Pete, thank you very much for joining us today and talking about these issues and giving us your perspectives. Pete Weber is from the Fresno Business Council, a board member there, and also a principal author of the report Choosing Our Future, which was commissioned back in 2005 by the district at one of its low points in terms of both financial and academic performance. And Pete, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure.
That's all for this edition of Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. As always, you can continue the conversation by sending us an email, talk@kvpr.org. You can also visit us online and listen to audio archives at kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, for reporter and producer Shelley Bronco, also for Tracy Sharman, who has the week off, and for Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio, KVPR Fresno, KPRX Bakersfield.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.